This is A Lost Plot, the podcast where we explore meaning in movies together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We're back again. It's your boy with another episode of A Lost Plot. I'm your host, Maverick, here with a wonderful guest back with us again, Patrick Avanto. Patrick, thanks for coming.
It's good to be here. Glad we can talk about another movie.
Oh, yeah. And he's got the scary stuff in the back for... this isn't... I thought this would be scarier than it was, but it's anticipatory. Anyways, The Marsh King's Daughter. That's what we're reviewing. It was released this year in 2023. It's labeled as a thriller. Its screenplay is by L. Smith and Mark L. Smith, and the directed by Neil Berger. It's based on the book of the same name, and it stars Daisy Ridley, our very own Rey Skywalker, as Helena Pelletier, Ben Mendelsohn as Jacob Holbrook, Garrett Hedlund as Stephen Pelletier, and Gil Birmingham as Clark. So, but before we get into the details, of course, you all know what it is. It's the overall. What is this movie about, Patrick?
This movie begins with a sort of a survivalist premise. Our lead is a little girl at the time, living with her father and mother. There's an estranged sort of relationship with the mother. The father is teaching her hunting and various survival skills, and she's not doing the best at it, but she's trying. And we kind of go through a day in the life of that situation until a person on an ATV shows up in the area, which is kind of jarring from the survivalist lifestyle that they've been living. Helena goes out and sees this man. He's asking if they know any direction home or whatever or the nearest road. And the mom comes out, pauses, recognizes what's happening, and she runs to the man saying that she needs help and that she's been kidnapped. And then a few events happen. The father is out hunting at the time. He comes back and he shoots the man, and the mother and the daughter escape on the ATV. Jump forward many years later, and there's an altercation sort of thing that happens in the sheriff's office. And then we jump to the future, where Helena is an adult. She has a daughter of her own named Marigold, which is a name that has a lot of symbolism, but we'll get to my gripe about symbolism in a little bit there. And she works a very boring office job, and she's hiding all of the signs of her past. And so there's sort of what seems like an element of PTSD from the whole situation. And sort of the part that moves the plot along is that her father, when he was arrested and taken to prison, he's being transported somewhere. It doesn't really say where, but he is able to escape. And so Helena is forced to confront her past because she believes her father is going to come back for her and her daughter. I could go through. Would you like me to go through the rest of the plot?
No. That's a good overall summary.
Okay.
Yeah. So based on, after having watched that movie, what was your overall rating out of the 9 points?
Out of the 9 points, total mathematically, I gave it a 5.7.
Okay.
But I do not feel personally that is low enough for me. I feel like it should be lower.
My rating was a 5.5. So okay. not far off. We're pretty close on here. So we'll get into it. But yeah, let's start with the opener. The opener, as you talked about, it starts with him in the woods, them being the Daisy Ridley being trained by the dad and all that stuff, and the conflict a little bit between the mother and the father and all that stuff. Was the opening overall one that caught your attention and made you want to keep watching?
I'm not going to lie. Okay. The opener started 2 minutes into it. I wanted the opening to end.
Uh-huh.
Don't get me wrong. It's not a terrible movie, but the opener was a long opener to get into the main plot of the movie.
Right.
And so I wrote it down here a specific way. I feel that the point and barb of the hook didn't pierce until way later into the first act.
No, that's definitely true. I felt like, so when you watch a commercial for this movie, you get the idea of, oh, this is this fast-paced action
thriller, high tension,
borderline horror, you know, like they're gonna have these this terrible, you know, out of nowhere freaky action going on. And then it starts off and it's pretty slow. It's really it spends a long, long time establishing the character.
I think one thing we're going to need to establish, so just so it's better than the way the movie did it, we'll put this here at the very start. The pacing was a very big issue for this movie. The 100%. Pacing was a massive issue for this movie.
100%.
It didn't know what speed to run at, so it didn't.
It didn't know what speed to run at, so it didn't run. That was funny. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you at the beginning. It started off slow. It could have done better. But, you know, it established, I think, enough of the premise to make the characters themselves compelling in the way they needed to be, which is really...
It gave everything we needed to know about the characters and kind of starting the trajectory that they would be going through with the story, with the exception of the mother... Because I feel like it rode on, it had very good acting. It had very good acting. But the side characters didn't have a lot going for it. So the mother, during the beginning, it talks about, or it sort of introduces that the mother is always mean to the daughter.
Right.
And it addresses potentially why later, but way later. Right. I looked at my watch and I was like, an hour has passed and this one plot thing hasn't happened yet that needs to happen to kick off the movie. Uh-huh. And it was around that time that we learned about the fact that the mother was kidnapped.
Oh, you mean like...
Well, may I rephrase that? We knew the mother was kidnapped, but we didn't know why she had such a cold relationship with the daughter.
Uh-huh.
Up until we learn all the details of it, and later it says... I'll just go to this now. Daisy Ridley eventually says that her mother couldn't look at her because she could see her father in the daughter.
Right.
Which is that's a thing. That's a real thing. Right. And when we start with the psychology of this movie, it's going to get a little muddy. But what it started with in the intro was building the roots of that. And there was one part that stuck with me, and I knew why it was going to stick with me. And I hate that I can predict this specific thing here. When she's out, I forget what she was doing. I think she was messing with ants or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or that was before, what the ants was before the, was right before the ATV guy came.
Yeah.
Right. There was a point where she goes to look at the river because she hears a commotion at the river.
And you see the,
and you see what it shows in the first part is he's picking up the mother and getting her to stand back up so that she, like, it looks like they fell out of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at that and I went, that's not real. That's not what happened. I hate that I can predict that, but I saw it. I go, okay, if this is a trauma movie, it's going to give us some things to look back at. And that was one of those.
Right.
Because once I saw kind of like the positioning, she's in front of him, but you're seeing them from the back, so you can't see her. The child's misremembering what happened.
Right. And that was the thing. Was this movie was very... What I loved about this movie was it showed it very much is like one of those books you read from the first person perspective of the main character, right?
Yes.
And so this movie was very, very good at showing everything that occurred in the movie from that perspective. So Daisy Ridley's character, Helena, was thinking about these things and she was caught up in some ways, the old nostalgic feelings of this other way of life.
And that is the thing. I'm going to cut you off for a second there.
Uh-huh.
That was the thing that made me start to question if I could even say this was a PTSD movie.
Interesting.
PTSD is fear of a memory.
Mm-hmm.
But all of her memories are fond. She's fond of them.
Right.
So I started like just angsting in the theater. Like, what would this be qualified as? It technically... She didn't have a traumatic event in her life up until the police got involved. Or up until that, you know, the ATV guy came.
Right.
So it for me, it was like, okay, well, it's fear of a memory.
Mm-hmm.
She's looking back, and what would be classified as like PTSD flashbacks aren't PTSD flashbacks. They're fond recollections of nostalgia. But I can wrap it back around, but we're going to do that in a little bit because
things need to progress. Well, and there's things that come to my mind that's like, okay, was that some sort of, well, we'll get to that. overall, the main character, did you think that she was flawed in a compelling way?
I'd say yes. I took down some notes. I took a lot of notes. I have to scroll a lot for my notes. Catalyst for marital issues. The whole event that her father escapes, and it's a catalyst for marital issues and protecting the family, a lesson she was taught by her father, the Marsh King. Her flaws that I think were good and compelling fit the narrative of a PTSD story, where she assumes that all people are predictable as she can predict them. So she made this assumption. And I love that they did this in the movie, because she made this assumption about her husband that was very hurtful to him.
Yeah.
And she didn't just own it, because she saw the hurt that it caused. And so then she went back and made things right in a way that I thought was really nice. I thought it was really cool when she walks outside and stops him from leaving. Yeah. And they have that confrontation about it. Right. I also wrote down that she's incredibly pessimistic, but that's also kind of in the predictable sense.
You mean given the scenario?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Actively causes her own issues due to her trauma being stronger than her better judgment.
Well, and now there was some things there that didn't even make sense, I didn't think. But maybe you have an explanation for that. Anyways, I would say she was completely flawed. Like, you could see, especially because of how they went through her character, even if you haven't experienced these things, you could still say, wow, she's really messed up. She really needs help. And you can empathize with the situation she's coming from and hope for her to get better past that. So it establishes a great baseline for growth and to see that character growth in the story. So it was a good,
We can look at it like a wave, because we have a contrast to when she was in a better place of mind at the beginning. When she was with her father, she was happy. And then the world turned topsy-turvy because things were revealed. And then it dips down into the pits of hell for a while. And then when it starts to come back up, it's because she's confronting those things that made her happy in the first place, but were framed in a bad way.
Yeah.
I think it was a very good way to make her a compelling character. It really worked out for me. I was really content with that.
What about the side characters? Did you think that they were
lackluster?
Go into that. What do you think?
I thought the daughter would have a much bigger part in being like influential to the plot. I thought she was going to be utilized in some way as a bargaining chip at some point because of the way the trailer made things look. I'm doing myself a disservice because I never read the book.
Well, yeah, I have not.
And
either.
Maybe I'll read it. This kind of didn't make me want to. But I mean, I'll have to at some point, and I will. But the daughter was kind of this big part of the film because that's who the father, that's who the Marsh King, the dad, I'm just going to call him the Marsh King. Mm-hmm. That's who the Marsh King eventually was going to start going for. And it tells you that in the trailer. Mm-hmm. And then you have like a few scenes with the daughter. Yeah. Now they technically pulled what Hereditary pulled on us, but in a worse way. And if you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. Because if you don't know, I'm not going to spoil it here. So the daughter, I would have loved to have seen more development with her. I liked that at least a few scenes that she was in. She did pretty well, but there wasn't enough to establish her with depth and character building or anything like that. She just kind of was, what's the term? She was just kind of Mary Sue. She was just a Mary Sue. And the husband, I liked the depth of the husband, but there just still wasn't enough screen time for him to establish himself as much more of a much more than just a supporting character that's written in to be supporting.
Right.
Because his main trajectory was he wasn't told, he gets offended, he starts to leave the house more, and then she confronts it and everything's better.
Rather than, which would have caused further conflict if she hadn't fully resolved it, that could have at least extended tension in the movie.
But it's like you get something, you lose something. So what I liked was that she confronted her past, but the consequence was any of the catalyst for those marital issues resolved the problem. So now there's nothing we can see the husband grow through.
And that's probably part of the reason why they took him out of the movie, because he didn't have a reason to be in the movie anymore.
Yep.
Yeah. That's, you know, and so interesting. You might have convinced me on this point, because I said yes. Because the father and then also the father-in-law were both, I would say, fairly developed in regards to their motives.
I liked the father-in-law. I wanted to see more of him. Because what we got was just a... I wrote it down as just a... nostalgia montage.
Oh, you mean at his house?
At his house and all that. I did like, again, this movie isn't, it's not bad. It's just so, it's too slow. And they focused on certain things that they didn't need to, or they extended certain things that they didn't need to, and neglected things that they could have done.
Well,
but it's a movie, and it happens. I loved Clark.
That's I would have loved just that's the father-in-law.
That's the sheriff, the stepfather.
Yeah,
I would have loved to have seen more of his development and less of his end. But that's he was compelling. He was very sweet. It shows you him at the start. He's the sheriff that comes in and talks to Helena when they first bring her to the sheriff's office, and you know, when you eventually hear that he basically adopted them both, I was like, oh, that's really sweet. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's cool. I like that a lot. That's a really fun dynamic to throw in there. And it's just kind of like heartwarming. And then it goes through a very brief sequence where they look at the picture and Helena doesn't remember the person in the picture or remember the picture being taken at all.
Right.
And then they leave. But he has a few like kind words of like, we should make this a regular thing. And I think of all the side characters, we're going to cut out the antagonist specifically from side characters.
Yeah, of course.
Of all of the side characters, Clark, I think, was the most developed.
Right.
But of the main side characters, 2 out of 3 weren't. So I can't say that the side characters were like well developed at all.
Right. Well, it's such a... So maybe
this movie's good at towing the line. Mm-hmm. I can say that.
This is why it makes me question some of the ways these at least the way the questions are worded, right?
Yeah.
Because they are driven by their own motives and needs, but at the same time, these subplots are resolved so quickly or simply thrown to the side that they don't really carry any weight in the movie. And so,
I could bring this to like a very funny example, because my first movie that I reviewed with you was D&D. I could bring this to a D&D example or just a general gamer example. If you played like a game with a ton of quests, this movie was the equivalent of watching the characters mostly complete all the side quests and then get to the end. And then when you realize that when you played all the side quests, you leveled up so much that the end doesn't take a lot.
Okay.
Am I wrong? Well, do you understand what I'm saying?
I think that's a little mean, but that's I think that that's kind of might be right.
What she did was she cleaned up. She She saw where she was having issues. She was having issues with her daughter. She was having issues with her husband, and she was having issues with Clark. There's contrast issues that were happening with both of them. There's a thing at the start of each of those different side plots that showed you the current state of things, and then eventually them working through it. And then leading up to her eventually going and confronting the Marsh King, but after she had gotten her affairs in order.
Hey everyone, quick note. Hope you're all enjoying the podcast. Before we get back to it, would love to get some feedback from you for us. That's right, we're looking for reviews. If you could just give us 5 seconds of your time, hit the little stars in the app that you're listening to it on right now, or give us a thumbs up if you're listening to us on YouTube or one of the other platforms such as that. Anyways, appreciate you guys' time helping us out, helping you guys get more of this great content. Now, back to the show. I don't remember if this was in the last podcast or the podcast before that, but I was talking about the idea of characters having something at stake when they're in the middle of conflict. And part of the idea of something being at stake is not just that you have an emotional attachment to someone or that you care about them, but also that there's unresolved issues there.
Yes.
And so, you know, like even like the stereotypical issue of when somebody dies, somebody will say, oh, I wish I had said this. And it's not something like, oh, I love you more generally. It's, I wish I had resolved this issue between us, right?
Yep.
Those are the things that haunt them till the day they die. And that's part of the problem is that when characters in stories, in real life, whatever, when people die, if there are these unresolved things, that makes that loss so much greater.
Look at how Saving Private Ryan develops its characters, where each of them in some way tell you about their past and what they want to go back to. And while not specifically saying, I want to go back home to my mother, when they say like a fond story of their past, you know that's what they're looking forward to. They don't need to say anything. They'll mm-hmm. just tell a nice little story. And then you know that their heart is somewhere else. And when they die, you're like, ah, oh. And those people yeah. are just waiting for them, and they're just going to get a Dear John letter, I think is what it's called. Yeah. I agree. There has to be something at stake. You don't need to be so explicit with how you make characters at stake or have something at stake. Mm-hmm. It's good writing to do that.
At the end, or when there's the middle of the conflict between the Marsh King and Helena, which we'll get to in a minute, there's a chance of sacrifice still, especially because of Marigold, mm-hmm. but it's a lot less meaningful of a sacrifice if all other issues have been resolved in her life. And so she did the right thing in a actual scenario. Yes, you 100% should go and resolve your problems.
I don't
go
to a movie to watch people start by doing the right thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so that's kind of the problem here. And so it's interesting because you said that these side characters really aren't compelling because they're cut out so early, which is not something I considered. I would consider those characters are compelling, but because they are cut out so early, and secondly, because there's so few characters in this movie, those mm-hmm. characters being cut out actually affected the story a lot. So you're really stuck with two or three characters left in the entire movie, and that makes it hard.
I'd even add this. Those characters getting cut out the way they did were also supposed to be the bargaining chip for the plot of the final fights. Exactly. I expected there to be more than one fight.
So we'll get to that. I'm curious.
We'll get to that. But So if the whole point brought to you in the trailer is that she has to go and protect her daughter should be involved in the plot during the point that the fight is happening. Even if she just like wandered onto scene.
Sure. Yeah. Rather than just a homage mention of we're going to.
Yeah. Because it's just like, I'm going to go get Marigold. And it's like, how long did she travel to get where she's at now?
Right.
The side characters that were at risk, that were in danger due to mm-hmm. our antagonist, that not being present takes away from the sense of urgency.
That's true. And at the very least, they could have add attention to the movie by having those things there.
One of the things that happens in the movie, and this is just another little gripe that I had, was when he first gets out of the van, he crashes the van. I did make a note of this. I did like the shot, by the way, where the you're following the van, you hear the gunshots, you see it start to swerve, and then it hits the red car, but the camera keeps going.
Yeah,
at roughly the same speed. It didn't hold there or anything. Mm-hmm. I like that. I don't know why. It just hit me right.
It's so bad.
But there was a plot point made where she's having her worries about her dad being out on the loose, and she gets a call from the FBI. Clark is there. FBI comes by to pick her up, take her to the office, and it's revealed that they found a car that had two burnt bodies in it, unrecognizable. I think I put this in my notes too.
The gold teeth or whatever it is.
When reported that they found his body, they said both men were burned beyond recognition, and they used gold teeth as an identifier, which isn't valid DNA evidence.
Right.
That's just because of my field of study, but I'm like, they wouldn't have concluded that with gold teeth.
To play like the devil's advocate, I believe that they said in the movie that they would be doing the actual DNA test in the future, but at the same time, even in that situation, I think you wouldn't make a conclusive statement like that.
Nope, I would not have told the victims the potential victims that he's dead if we don't know conclusively that he's dead. If they still feel the need to do DNA evidence to identify, then I would wait till the DNA evidence comes before I tell somebody to calm down and relax because he's not out there. And this further proves it. And again, no, I can't say that yet because I haven't made this point. There's a lot of parallels in this movie from the first little, I'm just going to call the early life thing before it goes to her current age with her daughter. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call that part Act 1.
Yeah, it definitely was Act 1, yeah.
It was definitely Act 1, but Act 1 has a lot of parallels with the different lessons that she learns for her survivalist techniques that will come into play later on. So when the gold teeth made the appearance, I immediately was like,
yeah, well,
we know what's happening there, and we know what we know what kind of movie this is. So it does, just because of that, it doesn't convince you enough to be like, when she starts seeing signs of everything, being like, wait, is he, do you think he's still alive? Because we don't feel that same feeling with the characters.
Interesting. Yeah. So I assumed as an audience that you weren't supposed to feel that you were supposed to know that he was out there. But
yes,
it is an interesting question. If they had played it out in a way that you didn't know and you thought he was actually dead,
that's what makes the psychological horror more.
Right.
That's what would do it. Because when we come from our position of being beyond the fourth wall, watching the movie, and we see these signs, we're not as scared because we know exactly what's going on. And while she goes through the phase of not knowing what's going on, we're all just like, don't you get it yet? And that takes away how we feel the movie should go. That takes away how smart we believe the characters to be.
Interesting. That's an excellent point. I'm going to write that down real quick. that's a good one.
There's parallels that are made, the survivalist techniques and things like that is kind of where I was going, but then I got dragged into that.
I don't know if that note's going to help me, but that's okay. We'll we'll get on with that. Anyways, okay, so not to spend too much time on this, but did you think the setting was believable?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah,
thought so too. I think the only thing that took me out of it was just the FBI thing, but that was very minuscule compared to everything else.
Sure.
Okay. Everything seemed believable to me.
And we touched just briefly on the chance of sacrifice. I have a feeling that things are going to really get in the weeds later on. That's why I'm kind of speeding up on these questions. But the villain or the obstacle in the way, did you think that he was compelling? And did he have the means, the motivation, everything in there to destroy or manipulate, in this case, the main character to achieve his end?
I'd say yes, and yes.
Okay.
He has the means, but I always find it short-sighted when the villain trained the protagonist.
Right.
And then the villain gets locked away in a place that they can't practice their skills.
Okay. Interesting.
So for me, watching the movie and I see training montage at the beginning where you're learning how he's teaching the daughter, he's doing a skill transfer. He's using his skills to teach another person those skills at a younger age. Because he probably didn't learn them at a young age. He probably learned them a little older in life. That's just speculation for me. But
right.
The older teach the younger, and the younger typically try to push ahead and refine the skills of the older. Mm-hmm. This happens in business models, especially family business models. So when the plot of the movie revolves around, this is the daughter that I trained, and now I'm going to try to kill her, or I'm going to commit a crime of some kind that's gonna cause her to need to kill me and use the skills I taught her against me. Watched the movie The Hunted with Tommy Lee Jones and Benicio del Toro. Very good movie. Basically the same plot. Not familial, but you know, trainer fighting his trainee who's potentially become better than him.
Okay. Yeah.
It seemed like he was fine for the most part with saying goodbye. And then he turned around and went back to we can be a family again. It was a crappy attempt at gaslighting too when the you know, mom said you kidnapped her. Oh, she only said that when she didn't want to be with me anymore. And I was like, that's your retort. But also in that sequence, when they're having that conversation, she has the flashback with the corrected memory of the father torturing the mother in the river. And I was like, cool, yep, that was the little thing that I was waiting to see. Great. And I don't know, the point where they first make contact after the many years when she first sees her dad, which, by the way, the actor for the villain for the Marsh King, Ben, I love Hamilton. That dude, he's great.
Yeah,
he's like very
squirrels, you know.
Yeah, and it's like, again, both of these leads did really well for the part that they had. The acting wasn't the issue at all. They did really well. They made it really uncomfortable when she goes back to the cabin and he walks in and they have a brief conversation and he says, let's go for a walk. And the entire time I'm like, all right, what's going on here? Is she looking for the opportunity to kill him? Is she looking for resolution? Is she trying to see what her what his motivations are, what he wants to do?
Mm-hmm.
And then when they leave that situation, she says that she doesn't want him in their life anymore and that mm-hmm. she has her own life. I was like, good job, girl boss, yeah, whatever. And then she leaves and he walks the other direction. I was like, this is not, I mean, obviously we know, and this isn't to poo-poo on it. We know what's going to happen. We know that he's going to come back. Sure. Because if the movie ended like that, I'd have some real issues.
You're like, but I just paid money for this.
I paid money for this. The popcorn was worth, no. She comes back to the cabin area so she can begin her trek home. And Clark shows up, and then the Marsh King comes back. So somewhere along the way, even if it was just like a scene of following him as he walked through the woods, fighting his mind and being like, you know, being content with or not with whatever was just concluded with his daughter there. Mm-hmm. I feel like it would have been better than just he went off and then he came back and shot Clark because Clark had a gun on him.
Mm-hmm.
So for the most part, I found the Marsh King as an antagonist compelling. But there were certain things of his motivation that were like way too ambiguous or were just like either pretty stereotypical, we could be a mm-hmm. family again, or just not at all.
Right. So,
but I have to also consider the fact that he kidnapped a woman to start a family in the first place. So there's something up there anyways, but mm-hmm. we never got any sort of like expansion on that because the dialogue that could have been revealed in was way too short.
No, and so it's very interesting because a lot of this is a psychological, I can't even call it a psychological film. It's just a psychological movie in regards to not us as an audience, but what goes on in the characters' minds. And so, yes. Especially being familiar with it, which I'm much less than you, but definitely understanding the psychological side is important. And so for him, I gave half points for this section. And the reason was is because he is clearly a master of stealth. He clearly has the motive to want to see his daughter, to start a new life, and he's willing to kill people to get there. So he's got the motive.
He has the means. He's got the means and the motive.
Right. But then it's the mental thing. And so I chalked this partially up to the perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is, we don't actually get the full glimpse into the Marsh King's mind. We only get the perspective of Daisy Ridley's character, Hannah's mind.
Yes.
So you get the impression of, and this is what really throws it off,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the great part of the movie and part of the, like, this is where it bites back at itself part of the movie.
Yeah.
Where it's interesting that it is all from her perspective. And because it's playing it from her perspective, you have this really interesting thing go on at the beginning where she goes, my father, I mentally understand that my father kidnapped my mom and started a family with her in the woods and made me. And, you know, he's a terrible person. He's killed people, blah, blah, blah. She knows that mentally, but emotionally, she is clinging to this perspective of her dad, of being this kind, loving, nurturing man who takes care of her. And so there's a sense in which, in my mind, I thought of that as she's trying to almost cling to this image of him that she's shouting out all these other parts of him out of her mm-hmm. mind, or she's trying to at least balance it out the scales in her mind because she's only hearing negative from everyone else about this person.
Yep.
And she wants to cling to this positive side because that's what she experienced. And so that's what's interesting. Now, the thing that really comes back to bite against that is that when you come to the actual villain and you're trying to understand what he's even going to do, that's kind of confusing because you know that he kills people, but then you also know that he cares a lot about Daisy. And so based on the flashbacks we get, you don't really think he's willing to do any harm to her.
You don't feel like the character's at risk.
Yeah, exactly. So the stakes are kind of like, and she clearly seems to think that to some degree because she like drives out in the middle of the woods by herself, turns off her phone like a freaking idiot and then goes at him. This is just, there was clearly a high level of trust there. The turning off the phone thing just really torqued me off. Like, I was no, just... no one in their right mind. I don't care who you are.
Leave that tracker on. Yeah, exactly.
But that was a whole just like brain explosion for half a second moment in the movie. You know, besides that, it's just when they come to discuss with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know is when he walks away, you're partially like, oh, okay, that's a somewhat reasonable perspective for him to do, to just walk away. But then as you see these other flashbacks of who he is and what he's done, it's also, in my mind, it's reasonable after you get that understanding to say he was looking for an excuse to take her back, and he didn't have that after that discussion. And so when he sees Clark, he has that excuse. And it's irrational, it's unreasonable, but he just looks at him and goes, oh, she was planning this all along. She was willing to kill me if she needed to. She's not really on my side. I have to take things into my hand, and just goes overboard. That was my impression of how
he I can definitely see that being the case. Maybe even it's just once he sees Clark, it's all right, kill switch time, because people think I'm dead. And if this person sees that I'm alive, I think he trusted for a time that Helena would keep that a secret. But then the presence of Clark being a good Samaritan overcomplicated the issue. And so in defense of his cover, he had to kill Clark, which also was going to prove to create issues with having Helena know that. And so maybe even it could just be that because Clark was there, he had to kill Clark because witnesses, and no witnesses, no crime.
Right.
Also, to add just to this, disappointing number of kills in this movie. Disappointing.
I think the body count was up to like 5 or something like that.
Something like that. For a psychological, fast-paced thriller, so far I missed the thrills. I missed the
fast-paced.
You know, the fast-paced. The issue that I ran into with trying to figure out Helena in this whole thing. There's different ways that we can look at this, because the way that it sort of advertises itself in the trailer is that it's very much like PTSD focused. The only trauma that Helena experienced was, and there's actually a lot of statistics on this kind of thing, the police involvement that suddenly happened. Because in law enforcement courses and things where they kind of like combine law enforcement and psychology, there's a very large way that children primarily get traumatized by things we wouldn't even recognize would cause trauma. And one of those things that happens, especially in cities and things, is when police are involved in, like, say, apprehending a parent. It's very traumatizing for the kids to go through something like that, to have all those police officers suddenly in the home. Typically there's more than just an essence of unease in the air, and it traumatizes kids. So when we look at what happened with Helena and how for her whole life up until that point, things were just hunky-dory. And then once the switch is flipped, police are suddenly involved. Her mom beats her in the head with a rock, which, what the heck, also, by the way.
Desperate times call for desperate measures. I don't know.
I guess so. Technically, that's where her trauma started, was with the police involvement. So all of her associations, all of her PTSD sort of flashbacks and memories that keep coming to light shouldn't be the good things. It should be the police involvement, or maybe the embarrassment of being a child of this person, that because she went through multiple name changes. So there was an effect there as well. One of my interpretations of this movie is that while she has PTSD, we're not watching the PTSD. We're watching her rehash and try to make sense of the good memories instead. And that's why that's what we see. And so one of my interpretations was, sure, she could have PTSD, but it's not about that. It's about the fact that there's now this conflict of what she's feeling and what she knows, but she can't make sense of what she's feeling because what she remembers doesn't match what she knows now, which is why towards the end, because she was very confused most of the movie about what she was going to do. So when they have this conversation, by the river, and the one like memory where she's exploring and she sees them in the river, when the truth comes out there, we know at that point that she has gone through derealization. She's realized what's going on. She's no longer blinded by the nostalgia of her memories. She now sees the situation for as bad as it was. And that's what motivates her to continue doing what she's doing. And then who does she have memories of from that point on? Not her father, but her and her mother. From that point on, her father is right. No longer in those memories.
Interesting.
I think pretty much like that symbolism of her seeing the memory of her father actually being a bad person when she was a child was kind of the moving everything over to the trash can bin on your desktop and hitting delete.
Interesting.
Hard to say if it's focused on the PTSD. I don't think it is. And I have to prefix this with, I'm not a licensed psychologist, parentheses, yet, close parentheses. I'm working on it. Nice. So everything that I say here, if there's any research to refute it or anything like that, I am 100% willing to like read it and correct myself on all of that. Because I don't want to give any false information.
Of course. And if you have those comments for him, leave them down below. Forward them on.
Lostbot.com. Throw them at me in a paper airplane.
That's right. Okay, so is there something that you would say the main character, Helena, stands for? Something about her character, her situation that transcends the situation and makes it the right thing to do?
They kind of heavy-handed give you the protecting her family thing.
I would say so. Maybe if you want to just talk specifically about her compared to like an overall theme, you could talk about her wholeness or like seeking to be whole. That's another strong theme in the movie.
Seeking to confront. Right. Seeking to confront the past. Because I look at it as a heavy weight, a burden.
Right.
A big weighted vest, and she's never done anything about it up until the situation forces itself in her face. So for her, it's self-actualization. I think one of her biggest things was her willingness to actually confront issues.
Right.
Because, and this will go back to the whole side plots thing, a lot of times in movies, they don't get through all the other particular issues of their lives before getting to the main plot. So in this one, I did really like that they established her as like a very proactive person when it comes to that. She didn't stand for any BS. If she had to do something about it, she would do something about it. And it was hard for her. You could see it when she was just staring out the window after her husband comes in and says that he's going to go work in the office and probably fall asleep there. And then she goes out and actually does something about it. And I was like, cool. Yeah, that's a big part of her character that I'd say transcends the general rigmarole of a standard character protagonist type thing. That's what stood out to me the most, apart from confronting her past, because that's just part of it.
And she was definitely the biggest thing about this movie was, I was watching this and my only background for Daisy Ridley is Star Wars. And if anyone's listened to this podcast for any period of time, they know that I am not a fan of Star Wars 7, 8, and 9. And so
I think it'd be hard to find any fans of it that are willing to talk about
at least on this podcast, that's for sure.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm opening myself up to be attacked, so send those to me as well. If there's people going to correct my psychology, go for it. Send me that. But also, if people want to send me what I like a fight to what I just said, send those to me as well, because I don't know.
No, we don't. We don't like Star Wars, the new Star Wars here. But she played well in this movie, and so that was a big okay. Daisy Ridley's not a bad actress.
No,
just Disney sucks. So
did you watch Murder on the Orient Express?
A while ago, not recently, but yeah.
She's in it.
Oh,
she's
is
in
she?
That one. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yep, she does pretty well too there.
I couldn't say which of the train people she would have been. But,
which of the train people? I don't know how best I could answer that based off of you saying which of the train people. She was an aristocratic person.
I watched that 7 years ago, dude.
She was the only one Poirot interviewed outside of the train. But neither here nor there. That's not this movie, but one of the things that I was looking for, because I love when it happens, it's almost unavoidable, is that she's an English actress playing in an American role. I was just waiting for that accent to slip. And it didn't.
Yeah.
It didn't, because there wasn't a ton of dialogue in this movie.
So she had enough time to practice each line.
She had enough time to practice it and make it primo. Because I just recently rewatched the 2006 Silent Hill movie. And the lead actress is Australian. And for most of the movie, she does really well. And then she shouts like your judgment brings wrath or something. But she shouts it really loud. And it's really hard to control your accent when you're shouting at the top of your lungs.
Right.
And you just hear a slight change in the accent that made me go, you try, but there was no way you could fix that. And that's fine. The only reason I think it's entertaining is because I see a lot of little things in movies and it's really stupid.
That's your takeaway?
Yeah. That's the thing, is like, if it's something innocuous like that, it doesn't take away from the movie itself. It just makes you go, ha, and then that's it.
Yeah.
I was kind of looking for it from this, just because I was like, all right, this takes place where it says Marsh King. So that's like where the marshes are. And typically there's a bit of an accent that happens in those areas.
Right. That's true.
And so I waited for it to slip, but it didn't. Right. And so that, even though there wasn't a ton of dialogue, there were places where it could have definitely slipped. And that's a big testament to modern acting techniques and certain actresses like Daisy Ridley, where she's able to keep that down. And that was really good. So your turn on the...
So heightened tension. The hero is thrown from a bad situation to a worse situation with losses that cannot be reversed. Now, this question in many ways encompasses a big section of the middle of the movie. And that's because it's what happens in a lot of the middle of the movie. Overall, are they making it you more and more amped up for that final conflict at the end where everything gets resolved? How well did you think they did on this? On a sliding scale.
So the scale that I was given is, I believe, a scale of 1 to 2.5, or 0 to 2.5.
Right, correct.
I gave it a 1.
Yeah, I did as well. I think that that's pretty accurate. They had a couple times in there where you go, okay, I'm a little nervous what's going on, but those were more, I think, the way it was portrayed, honestly, than necessarily the situation itself.
I think there was only a few parts that actually like helped to build tension, but again, it was just an issue of the pacing. Like, I put that there was a survivalist montage when she's setting up the traps around the house with the bells on them. Exactly. And I was like, okay, cool. A small little Chekhov's gun that will fire soon. I love Chekhov's gun. I'm bringing it back again. A small little Chekhov's gun, a little Chekhov's bell over there on the rope. And when you hear it ring at night, I go, ah, or was it at night? Or was it like in the middle? It was at night because it was the rabbit, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So it rings at night. And I'm like, okay, cool. A little bit of tension here. But then in my head, I went, it's not going to be him. There's not going to be a threat there. It built up to it, but because we know what's going on right now in the movie, we don't need to know where the movie's going to know that that's not going to be him at all. We know it's going to be a fluke. I wrote it down in my notes. Once the bell rang, I said, it's a fluke.
Yeah.
And then it turned out to be the rabbit. And then she investigates the rabbit may have been killed beforehand, and that kind of added to it a little bit more. We needed more things like that, not just it's a disappointment because it wasn't him. The other thing was when the little effigies appeared in the daughter's room.
Right.
I liked that part. Very Blair Witch-esque with those effigies.
No, that's absolutely.
Ultimately, it didn't like build the tension for me.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing, right? So this is kind of the struggle of any creative storytelling endeavor, right? Is you generally have people thinking in more or less a binary term, right? Where you go, okay, she sets up this trap. Either the trap's going to go off or it's not. And then the trap goes off. Because, of course, if you're going to spend all the time showing us how to put up a trap, clearly it's going to go off. That's a reasonable assumption. So when you hear that, it's very easy for you to psychologically go, okay, we knew that was going to go off, so they want us to think it's going to be the person, which means it's not. right?
Yes.
And so when you have those situations, it sounds like either it's the bad guy or it's not the bad guy. And mm-hmm. you have to find some sort of third option. And the rabbit was kind of inching toward that, trying to grasp for that. But
the third option is put between. The way you're supposed to do that, the rule of Chekhov's gun is if you introduce a gun in Act 1, it must absolutely go off in Act 3.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There has to be a space there. And the way that the trap could have worked is, I'm going to briefly go to that in a second here. My expectation for the movie was that there was going to be two fights. Mm-hmm. It was going to be that she goes to the cabin and confronts him there, fails, and then he goes to their home.
Right.
That was my expectation for it all. Yeah. And so I was thinking, okay, she sets up a trap. I don't expect it to go off yet. I expect it to go off way later. Mm-hmm. But right. because it went off so quickly, it told me that it's not him.
Right.
So that third element for Chekhov's gun has to be time between it.
Right.
It has to be a lot more time in between it. Otherwise, if you set up a mouse trap expecting to kill a mouse, and you set it up and then you walk out and it snaps immediately, I would look at that and go, all right, I must not have set it right. And then when I go over, I'm not disappointed with the fact that I got that correct.
And the other thing about that too is that, especially in a Chekhov's gun, like we're just talking about specifically this bell, you mm-hmm. And just to be very clear, this is a bell on the perimeter of her property for anyone yes. who's listening. For this situation, if they play it out in the way that Patrick just described, part of the tension is you have built up the tension up to this point that you really don't want to see him come, but mm-hmm. then when that goes off, that is signaling that doom, right?
Yes.
And that's what you're terrified of. But then also when she goes out to inspect it, he's not going to be there.
Yeah.
And that adds extra foreboding to the situation, which is how you do this, throwing from a fire, like out of the frying pan into the fire, where you go, okay, we're scared of him. He shouldn't be here. He shouldn't be here. Oh, he is yeah. here, but now we don't even know where he is. That safety check mark didn't really work. Now we're just terrified.
My ideal way that I would have seen the bell work would have been if the whole thing progresses, there's no rabbit that occurs. That doesn't happen. The bell doesn't get triggered at that time. And she goes to this confrontation, which she believes to be the final confrontation. And she presumably defeats him. Mm-hmm. And then she goes back home, relieved. And she goes to bed. Her husband's there. Her daughter's asleep. And then you hear the bell. Mm. That would have made it so much better.
Yeah, because then you think...
Because at that point, you'd also have forgotten about the bell.
Right.
And then it goes off and you're like, oh.
And if they played it right, you would think he's actually dead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's where you don't do the... Oh, but is he really dead thing? No, you make it look like he's actually dead.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No,
that's where you scare the yeah. crap out of people.
So overall, yeah, the tension thing for me is like, there were moments that made it start to increase its tension. There mm-hmm. weren't enough of them, and they were too far apart, or so small that they didn't affect the overall feel of the tension through the whole movie. Mm-hmm. So I gave it a 1, because... It did build, like, through its plot that there's going to be some tension to it. And yeah, there kind of is in the concept of it. But in the application and action of it, it didn't really go beyond that. So I put a 1 for that reason.
Was there, in regards to revelations, was there a knockout surprise ending? Or was there a revelation in the movie which changed everything for you?
Nope.
Yeah, that definitely was not the case for me either.
The only thing that would have qualified as a revelation would have been just when the memory of the river thing was inverted.
Right.
That's the only thing that would have qualified. Yeah. But it didn't, like, we knew it was happening so early on, even though, like, I didn't read anything mm-hmm. about the movie. When you messaged me about it, that was the first time I had ever heard about this movie.
Right.
I think it should get a little bit more attention, because I think the more eyes that look at this movie, it would be a bit more helpful to see other opinions of it too. But the advertising just didn't do this movie any favors.
No, and that actually has been seen in the box office. This thing didn't even break 1 million in revenue. So
yeah, now it's at 849,000.
Yeah, pretty bad. So, you know, especially because they have big name actors like Daisy Ridley
yeah.
or Ben Mendelsohn, Like, these are not nobodies.
They're not sheep. They're not nobodies. Those are some big people out there. As far as for reveals, I didn't get anything. Like, everything seemed too handed to you to make anything a reveal.
Right. Well, especially because even that one with the mother, you already kind of know that's how he is toward her. Yep. Because that's what she says to her daughter, and what you hear in the news stories and all that kind of stuff, that you kind of already know that that's how he is. You just don't really have her acknowledging that and seeing that in her mind's eye.
Yeah. Oh, there was a thing. I just remembered this part. Regarding, like, the only term I can use for describing Daisy Ridley's character was her indoctrination. Mm-hmm. Her indoctrination by her father. And the way too on the head or on the nose line where the mom is crying in the police station. Uh-huh. And she says, "We're not supposed to cry." And I was just like, one, the environment that she was raised in doesn't lend itself to her talking to her mother like that. She also has a cold relationship with her mother anyways. So I don't think she'd even broach saying that to her mother in the first place. And I was just like, that's too on the head to be like, oh, this child is damaged and she's been indoctrinated by this crazy man. We got that. Mm-hmm. We didn't need one more nail in the coffin that didn't even like hold the lid on. It just kind of stabbed the body inside.
Yeah, interesting.
We come up with a lot of stupid analogies. I'm sorry.
No, it's interesting because when I saw that, and granted, I'm not as big into the psychology field as you are, but that was the first clear sign in the movie to me that she was seeing everything all wrong. You don't really need that to know that she's seeing everything all wrong, but it's definitely like a big signpost to point you in that direction.
I agree in the sense that it works better if you do something like that where the whole movie isn't in first person perspective of the protagonist. That's a better thing to do if you're bouncing between perspectives, because for me, the jarring nature of it didn't fit the unreliable narrator kind of thing about the movie. You wouldn't be given something so jarring if you're following her perspective. She wouldn't say something like that anyways in the consistency of her character and how she was established to be with her mother in the first place. Mm-hmm. Maybe she was pissed off at her mom. That could be it. But if you're doing the entire movie from her perspective, I feel like having an indicator like that is too on the nose. If you're going first, if you're going that the singular
right, perspective. Like, you mean that specific line?
That specific line, that specific delivery. Indulge the unreliable narrator thing. She doesn't need to say that because there's no way that we're going to be able to tell if we're working from her perspective, or that she's not going to give us any indicators that blunt and on the head about how she's been indoctrinated. Normally, unless she's like, I'm actually not going to make that comment. Never mind. I'm not going to make the comment that I was about to make. It's so on the head. If you haven't seen Shiny Happy People on Amazon, please do that. And
oh man,
then oh, at boy. Me.
Oh boy, that's a reference. oh boy. All right. So transformation. Daisy Ridley's character grow as a person? Is she better off morally, spiritually, etc., having gone through this? What do you think?
She definitely had a transformation. I begrudgingly gave this one a one. One total, just because
for the entire transformation, including section. Theme and everything like that.
Yeah, because she did transform. She did go through her character arc. She was able to confront her past and reconcile those memories and things. And she was able to let go of the high regard she had for her father at the end, symbolized by, as I mentioned before, her flashbacks not being about him anymore, but being about her and her mother. I think that was kind of our point of view perspective indicators that she had transformed, she had grown, she had changed. I say begrudgingly because it would have been nice to get a good little denouement showing us how she's different, how she's lightened up a lot more. But we just didn't get that. So pretty much the only way we can say that we got a transformation was just what was given to us bluntly at the end when she finished confronting things. And then that was it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
I think the other thing too, though, is we can see the transformation in the way that she actually hit a shot. She actually finally hit a shot. Or two, technically.
Oh, you mean like earlier when she misses compared to...
She missed every shot she took in the movie up until the end.
I think the idea of exploring, of going back to... especially in... what's his name? The Hero's Journey. I can't think of Campbell's Hero's Journey, right? Where they go from the beginning and they leave their place. They go on this adventure and they figure out the stuff and they go through all this trial and they... face their fears and all of that stuff, and they come back and they then resolve that and go back to their old way of life, right? I don't know that that always needs to be manifested in a full way to show that. I could see how it could be nice, but they've already drawn out so many other things in this movie that I didn't feel like it's a big deal that they didn't draw that one out personally. They just hinted at, okay, she's going back home. She's kayaking after those terrible wounds back to her family and everything's going to be all right. And to some degree, too, we have already seen a lot of the transformation that she should have seen earlier with her husband and coming to terms with him and other things like that. So you do see some of those things that you probably would have wanted to see if the movie had been a little more conflict ridden
at the end in the middle.
So I guess I
could phrase it this way then. I think the character transformation happened in chunkier but smaller steps throughout the movie. So by the end of it, the big conflict that she's dealing with herself, when it's changed, when she deals with it, when she's transformed, it doesn't feel as big. Because she went through a bunch of other things too, with the confronting the marital issues thing, with the treating her daughter better, with the conflict she had with just even talking to Clark. And those all got handled in chunks throughout the movie. And then by the end, when she's able to confront her past, it's just a bit of a bigger chunk, and that's it. Because I think a lot of the times when I think of transformation through the movie, there's usually a moment in the movie where all of those different changes come to a head.
Right. That's true. That's true.
And in this one, we didn't quite get that because those different heads came up at different points. And then that last one, by comparison, was just a slightly bigger head that the point came to. And then it was done and it was over. And that was the transformation.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. And that's maybe the bigger issue with the movie. And that leads to the last section, honestly. Did the movie leave you with a desire to watch the next one? Did it leave you satisfied or did it leave you unsatisfied?
I was unsatisfied. In our conversation, I think something that I can say about the movie, it's not bad. Its pacing made it end way too late. It didn't give itself the credence that it could have gotten if it had like gone through at a better pacing. But I can also say, because it's a funny point that we made earlier, for movie plot, it didn't do well. For a general way of handling your life, it did very well.
Handle your
affairs. Get your affairs in order and do them. Just do it. And that's what she did. And I really liked that. But then I was like, this doesn't translate well to film for that particular thing, I guess.
Right.
It left me disappointed just because of that. Once I said to myself, the credits better not roll right here. And then they did, and I was like, all right. Because she kayaks out, and then I was like, that's it.
That's
you
it.
Know, the final confrontation was so short water afterwards, and it was two shots that were fired. And then I realized that an hour into the film, he didn't even make an appearance, apart from him getting out of the van. He didn't make an appearance as a primary threat to the protagonist until over an hour into the film. Right. And knowing that the movie is an hour and 48 minutes long, I was like, all right, well, they better like do something about this. And then I think another 15 minutes passed because he really wasn't a problem wasn't really a problem until, I want to say, the last 20 minutes.
Right. Well, honestly, I almost wonder if that the wood doll effigy thing that showed up in the daughter's room, if that didn't exist, would this movie even be compelling? Right. I mean, because honestly, that just like makes the borderline scariness of the movie exist. Yeah. And if that wasn't there. Yeah, he got in the house and he walked out and everything looked like he had never been there except for that little speck of dirt. Except for
the little effigy. So I was like, well, the speck of dirt was explained by the daughter.
Right.
She walked in with the money. It was like
plausible deniability at the very least. And then it's like,
I think I didn't even get threat from the effigy. Sure, I got, he can get into the house. But it, for me, like, the effigy should have been a place where it was more threatening. As well. Mm-hmm. It was compelling because, he got into the house, but I hate to use this term, but the vibe of it was like, he's waving at the granddaughter. Oh, hi, how's it going?
Yeah, that's true.
Versus if it ended up like in her bed, not in the daughter's bed, but in Helena's bed.
Right.
That would have made it significantly more threatening. But he wasn't there to threaten them.
Right. Well, and that's technically the
whole thing. Wasn't a risk at all up until
she finally
met him again.
Right. Yeah.
Which is like, now that makes me sad about the pacing of it. Sorry, you were saying.
No, you're absolutely right, because that's the whole thing, is that once again they put themselves in a bind because you don't know what, you don't know where he stands, and he doesn't even know to a certain degree where he stands, and so he can't really be a threat until he understands where she is, and she doesn't really know if he's a threat until she understands where he is, you know. And they have to have that meeting, and until they have that meeting, the conflict really is just on a you know, just on a balance, you know. You're just the waiting for it to dip one way or the other.
It's literally in her head, which then comes back down to the fact that yes, this is technically a psychological, air quotes, thriller. It's more psychological than thriller, because if we broke it down into its main themes, looking at it from after finishing the movie and knowing what's in it, there's no threat up until the last 20 minutes of the movie, and all the threats that are perceived are in her head. Mm-hmm. And she's already established herself at really good with dealing with problems, so we're not terribly worried.
So I did put down, just as a side, that this movie did leave me satisfied. I was okay with the ending. Mm-hmm. I didn't love the ending. I didn't hate it though either. I thought, okay, they brought everything over to an adequate conclusion. And I think this is definitely, of all the questions, one of the most how do you feel about it kind of things.
And so I guess the only way I can say it is dissatisfied, but it's so on the cusp. I mentioned earlier that this has so many like moments and concepts that toe the line for me between whether I liked it or not.
Right.
I would watch it again after I read the book.
Interesting.
I would watch it again after I read the book, because I wasn't that dissatisfied. I was just like, once I got a feel for the pacing, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I'm more disappointed than dissatisfied.
And that's probably a good way to put it. I know for me, like, would I watch it again if someone else was watching it? Yeah, maybe. I mean, I thought it was enjoyable for a one-time watch. Would I go out of my way to watch it again? No, probably not.
Nah. I wouldn't say, hey, we should go watch The Marsh King. But if somebody said, I want to go watch The Marsh King, I'd be like, yeah, let's go watch it.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be my choice.
Right. And I think especially after you got me on the side of the side characters not really being that strong, because they get axed pretty quickly in results to screen time. That does bring my review overall down. It's overall at about a 5, which I think is probably about where I would be. That's where
I'd put it too. I think I'd put it at a 5. I'd say anywhere between a 5 and a 5.2. Because it wasn't. Movies that I'd probably put at a 5, I feel like would be worse. So I just want to put it just a bit above that, because it's not a bad movie.
No,
it's just it gets caught up in itself, and it's the thing that happens with book to film adaptations. I imagine the book is a lot more thrilling because we can't quite get into the head of a character in a film the same way we can with a book.
True. And because this is so reliant on what's going on in our heads, that's kind of a crucial part of it.
Exactly. And that's not even a fault of the filmmakers. It's just a byproduct of the medium. That's the byproduct of film.
I think that's the pod. That's all we got. We hope you all enjoyed. We will be back next week, and we look forward to seeing all of you back again then.